I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Colin Powell has tendered his resignation along with three other cabinet members. We'll have more on the Bush cabinet reconfigurations later in the program. But first, American military officials say U.S. and Iraqi troops have overrun the last pockets of insurgency in Fallujah. U.S. officials say the battle has been shorter, the casualties fewer than expected. Meanwhile, Marines in Fallujah found the disemboweled body of a Western woman wrapped in a blanket. She's not been identified. Margaret Hassan, director of CARE International in Iraq, and Teresa Bors-Khalifa, a Polish woman and longtime resident of Iraq, have been missing since last month. Joining us on the line from Washington is Eric Schmidt. He's Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, as you know, Eric, this weekend, chair of the Joint Chiefs General Richard Myers flew into Baghdad from Washington, and Central Command Chief General John Abizaid flew in from regional headquarters in Qatar. Some reporters are interpreting this meeting, this high-level meeting, as a sign that U.S. officials feel they're close to sort of a tipping point in the war in Iraq. Your thoughts?
Oh, I don't think they're anywhere near a tipping point, Robin. I think what you had here was the chairman had to postpone a visit to Iraq about a month ago because of security and other issues. He went back in, as you pointed out, in the last day or so. And while he was there, he would naturally meet with the overall commander in the region, John Abizaid, as well as the commanders in Iraq. Now, clearly, he is very interested in finding out about how the operations have been going in Fallujah and what that bodes for the, you know, for beyond Fallujah, the rest of the country. But I don't expect to see any major shift in strategy because of his visit.
Well, the title of your piece in the Times today is "With Capture of Fallujah, a Goal is Met." Is Fallujah totally captured, and what was the goal that was met?
It is and it isn't. I mean, the sense is the American military now occupies and essentially controls the city. Obviously, they're doing clearing operations. They're going to have sporadic fighting that will be going on there for some days to come, and there's a ways to go there. But what they've been able to do, commanders say, is eliminate perhaps the major safe haven for insurgents in Iraq by routing them out of the city. Now, of course, that's just pushed them elsewhere, and we're seeing that with fighting that's popped up everywhere from Mosul to Baquba to Ramadi, just 30 miles away or so from Fallujah. So there's plenty of hard work ahead on the ground in a military sense, but there's also some very difficult work ahead in the economic reconstruction of Fallujah and of trying to continue to move along the political process in preparations for the elections that will be held or scheduled to be held in Iraq in January.
Is there a sense that U.S. forces will move into Ramadi or Mosul where there is fighting in the same way they moved into Fallujah?
Well, unlike in Fallujah where there were no U.S. troops and there had been no U.S. troops since last April, there have been American forces in both Mosul and Ramadi for the past several months. What you're seeing is probably going to be a renewed focus on these two cities, Ramadi, which is very close in the provincial capital of Al-Anbar province, which is the large western province in Iraq. And so you're going to see, we've already seen some fighting there. Mosul is a more difficult issue. The Americans, as you pointed out, were taken back by some 500 insurgents that waged a series of attacks on police stations, stole dozens of vehicles, hundreds of weapons, and most, I think, worrisome, many, many uniforms of police officers. So you now essentially have an imposter police force out there, and they've had to suspend police patrols in the city because they don't know the good cops from the bad ones.
Yeah. And in addition, there are reports that the battle in Fallujah has become a big recruiting draw for volunteers from Syria to Saudi Arabia. And the reports we're hearing of hundreds of rotting bodies in the street of Fallujah might be helping that recruitment.
Well, and this is exactly why commanders have been saying from the beginning of this operation that as soon as it's secure enough, they are going to rush in reconstruction efforts. And this will be initially it'll be humanitarian aid, food, water, medicine, and such. But quickly behind that, they want to start the essentially the cleanup and rebuilding of Fallujah, just so it does not become a rallying symbol for insurgents around Iraq and around the rest of the Middle East.
And finally, and briefly, Eric, one of the goals was to allow Fallujans to be able to vote in the upcoming elections to free the city so that they could do that. Is that going to be possible to rebuild so they could live there and vote?
That's a big question right now, Robin. And the whole issue is security. Will the people in Fallujah, will they come back to their homes again? Remember, maybe 75-80% of the city had fled in advance of this offensive. So now they have to create the conditions where people felt safe enough to return to their homes and safe enough to go to polling places or go to registration places and sign up again. No doubt the insurgents will continue to try what's been a fierce intimidation campaign in Fallujah as they are through the rest of Iraq to try and drive people away from this process.
Eric Schmidt, Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times. Eric, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, a federal court ruling on prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay facility in Cuba throws into question the fate of hundreds of detainees being held as enemy combatants there. Midway through a military commission hearing last week for Osama bin Laden's former driver, a federal judge ruled the process was fatally flawed, saying it improperly brushed aside the Geneva Conventions. And that decision follows a June Supreme Court ruling which said Guantanamo detainees have the right to challenge their detentions in federal court. The two decisions raise legal questions, just as the Bush administration has nominated Alberto Gonzalez to the position of Attorney General. It was Gonzalez who wrote the 2002 memo to George Bush, in essence advising him to deny Geneva Convention rights to prisoners in the war on terrorism. Well, joining us to talk about the Guantanamo decisions is Duke University Professor of Law Scott Silliman. Welcome, Professor.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Robin.
And let's start by talking about the decision last week by Judge Robertson, which abruptly halted Saeed Ahmed Hamdan's trial. He's Osama bin Laden's former driver. What were the problems there? What were the alleged violations of the Geneva Convention?
Robin, what the judge did last week was say that only a tribunal convened under the Geneva Conventions can make the decision as far as whether Hamdan, in this case, and perhaps others down at Guantanamo Bay, are prisoners of war or not. The president, 2.5 years ago, said that he had no doubt that any of the people we were detaining at Guantanamo Bay were in any way prisoners of war. He concluded they were not. The judge last week said the president does not have that authority. That decision can only be made under the conventions, and therefore everyone who is facing a military commission is presumed to be a prisoner of war, and a military commission cannot be used to prosecute them.
And let's remind people that the president made that decision that they were not prisoners of war because he said that many of these detainees worked for Al-Qaeda, which was not a traditional army and not covered by the Geneva Conventions.
That's exactly correct. And he also went on to say that members of the Taliban, who we have detained at Guantanamo Bay, they are also not covered under the convention because they failed the test under the convention. So for both reasons, the president concluded that no one down there enjoys the benefits of a prisoner of war. That's what Judge Robertson faulted last week.
Well, we know that the Geneva Convention requires that a tribunal decide whether a detainee is actually a prisoner of war. And we also know that the Supreme Court decision last June says that Guantanamo inmates can challenge their detentions and what they're being called. So since June, there have been a series of hastily set up hearings to determine whether inmates are enemy combatants or POWs. Is that satisfying the questions that are being raised?
No, it's not, Robin, and that's specifically what Judge Robertson ruled last week. He said that the combatant status review tribunals were not the same as a Geneva Convention hearing, and that barring any kind of a hearing under the convention, these people must be treated as prisoners of war who are being prosecuted down there, and they can't be prosecuted by a military commission. They can only be prosecuted by a court-martial, which has inherently greater due process, or in our federal courts.
It's very confusing, Professor, as to what's happening because there's so many different hearings, tribunals, things going on there.
That's very correct, Robin. Let me take a moment to go ahead and say what is happening at Guantanamo Bay. First of all, the military had initially decided that once each year, all the detainees at Guantanamo Bay would be screened to see whether they were of further intelligence value, and if they weren't, they would be released. The second type of administrative hearing is the one that came into being immediately after the Supreme Court ruled last June, and again, its only purpose is to show to a federal judge who is reviewing the detention of an inmate, of a detainee down there, that the military has given him some due process and that there is reason to hold him because he is an enemy combatant. The third type of hearing is the military commission. That's a prosecution of up to six people down there who have been charged. That's a criminal trial. Mm. So all those things are happening at Guantanamo Bay. What the judge said last week was that a Geneva Convention determination a what's called a competent tribunal to decide only one question, whether an individual is a prisoner of war or not under the convention. That has not been done.
Well, now the U.S. has appealed last week's court decision, but some, including a New York Times editorial, say don't waste any more time challenging these court decisions. Just comply. Change the flawed process. Give the U.S. back some of its international credibility when it comes to the way it treats prisoners. Your thoughts?
There's some merit in that suggestion, Robin. What that's really saying is let's treat these people as prisoners of war, and as prisoners of war, let's prosecute them by a military court-martial. That's the same type of trial that we use for our own servicemen. It has credibility all over the world, and it's that point that many in the international community have been making for some time. Even Colin Powell suggested 2.5 years ago that we should have properly determined whether these individuals are prisoner of war or not.
And now we have the likely prospect of Alberto Gonzalez following John Ashcroft as Attorney General. And as we said, Alberto Gonzalez, the one who wrote the 2002 memo to George Bush advising him to deny Geneva Convention rights to these prisoners. It's not likely, then, that there will be some changes in a post-John Ashcroft Justice Department.
I don't think we can be totally sure of that, Robin. The memo that Judge Gonzalez wrote way back in January of 2002 was part of a decision that the president had to make as far as whether the Geneva Conventions applied in Afghanistan. And there were conflicting recommendations. One was coming out of the Department of Justice and the Department of Defense that said the Geneva Convention should not apply at all in Afghanistan because it was a failed state. Colin Powell and his lawyer came in with a separate memo and saying, historically, we've never done that before, and we ought to treat Afghanistan as a place where the conventions apply. Judge Gonzalez then wrote a memo to the president in which he basically suggested that the conventions perhaps wouldn't be totally appropriate. But nonetheless, I don't think he was basically saying to the president, we must deny all these people all their rights. I think that overstates it. We'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, and then U.S. officials face another problem. We heard on Friday about the Uyghurs. These are Muslim Chinese that the U.S. officials have been detaining but now realize are innocent and they want to send them home, but they can't because they're persecuted in China.
And you know, that's a much larger problem, Robin. My guess will be that we will have no more than 15 criminal trials by military commission or court-martial down at Guantanamo Bay. And the rest of the 550-odd people down there, the United States wants drastically to send back to their home countries, but they're running into exactly that type of problem. The United States is saying, we want you to assure us, Saudi Arabia or Somalia, that these people will not be let loose to attack us again. And these countries are saying, but they're innocent, and therefore we're not going to make that assurance because they're innocent people. So remember when we're talking about 580-odd people being detained, in order to prosecute them, you have to frame a particular charge of a crime under the law of war. And we're not getting enough good information to be able to do that except for about a handful of people.
Professor, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
Scott Silliman is a professor of law at Duke University. Well, if the U.S. is trying in good faith to reduce its detainee population, why is the prison expanding? Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we've been talking about Gitmo. And while questions may surround the legality of detaining so-called enemy combatants at the Guantanamo Bay facility in Cuba, the U.S. is forging ahead with plans to expand the facility itself, adding a permanent 200-bed compound expected to cost somewhere around $25 million. Well, joining us now is Vanessa Blum. She recently wrote about the expansion plans for the Legal Times. And Vanessa, we just heard Professor Scott Silliman from Duke University say that only 15 out of more than 500 detainees are slated for trial. And he speculates that the U.S. is trying to send the bulk of them home, but can't for various reasons. So given that, why the new facility?
I think what we're seeing is a shift from makeshift holding facilities to more modern prison structures, similar to what you'd find inside the United States. Right now, the majority of detainees are kept in Camp Delta in long blocks of metal cells. They have roofs and walls, but the cell blocks are still somewhat exposed to the elements, and it's not really a practical long-term situation. I think the idea is to move prisoners from that sort of facility to more long-term structures. Construction completed earlier this year on a supermax-style prison, and it is, as you mentioned, and expected to begin soon on a medium security facility.
The U.S. Did respond to that Supreme Court decision last June, which said that the government can't hold enemy combatants indefinitely without giving them a chance to challenge their detentions. And you write that the population has been at its lowest level since June of 2002. But still, you also quote a military law expert who says that Guantanamo is a prison in search of a theme, and it's morphing into the human equivalent of Yucca Mountain radioactive waste facility. Your thoughts on that?
There is an effort in the wake of that Supreme Court decision, and possibly even before then, to whittle down the number of detainees to those who are truly dangerous or have valuable intelligence. There's been so much criticism that there are still low-level actors being held at Guantanamo Bay, and I think the Pentagon is trying to correct that. It hasn't moved very quickly, but it is taking steps. One of the problems is the government does need to release these detainees back to their home country or some other country that agrees to take them in. And that sort of negotiation just involves a lot of diplomacy, a lot of red tape, and it can't be worked out overnight.
Yeah. Well, human rights advocates, as you know, are up in arms about this new facility. They say the U.S. is going in the wrong direction. But you've been to Guantanamo several times. Do you think that this is actually something the U.S. needs to do, even in the short term, because of the housing there?
Well, I think it's a very difficult situation. I mean, it's easy to see the point made by human rights activists that we are holding people indefinitely without trial, which is troubling. But we still have a challenge, which is that the United States captured people on the battlefield in Afghanistan and the surrounding regions. There are numbers of people who are suspected of having ties to Al-Qaeda, and something has to be done with them. So in the short term, I think it is a good thing to move the prisoners out of these makeshift metal cells into more humane and efficient structures, which, again, are similar to what you'd find inside the United States.
And you also write about military officials who talk about the problems of releasing some of these individuals.
Well, there certainly is a risk in releasing individuals from Guantanamo Bay back to their countries. At this point, the government has released more than 200 prisoners from Guantanamo Bay. When I spoke with folks in September, I was told that 7 had returned to fight against U.S. forces. Now that number is up around 10, I believe. So there's clearly a risk, but the odds aren't actually that bad. That's somewhere around 5% recidivism, and we see much higher numbers of prisoners within the United States, you know, being released and committing future crimes.
And remind us the importance of Guantanamo Bay itself. I mean, the one of the reasons that the military might want to have a permanent facility there is that it's U.S. land, but it's not on the continent proper.
Well, initially, the U.S. government hoped that it had found a place where its operations would be on the reach of U.S. courts and interference from the judicial branch. That didn't turn out to be the case, but it still remains a remote piece of land. There's little possibility of anyone escaping. There's no possibility of interference from foreign governments the way there would be if we set this prison up somewhere in Afghanistan or Pakistan, for instance.
Yeah. Well, another facet of the construction plan that's getting a lot of attention is the fact that the contract to build this new permanent prison in Guantanamo Bay was awarded to Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root. Now, the White House has come under fire for giving Dick Cheney's former employer no-bid contracts. How was this contract awarded?
When the same contract was awarded in 2001, I believe there were three firms considered, including the Halliburton subsidiary. So it doesn't seem that there is a consideration of a large number of companies, and I'm actually not certain whether any other companies were considered besides the Halliburton subsidiary when it was awarded most recently.
Mm. And the designer of the new facility hasn't been saying much, but you do quote him as saying that it's a different kind of prison than, let's say, a prison that would be on the mainland, because the one goal of this prison is to get intelligence.
Certainly one of the elements it will have to incorporate is ease of access for interrogators. Right now, interrogations take place outside of the actual, you know, prison cell areas. And moving prisoners out of their cells to an interrogation site can require a lot of guards and take a lot of time and manpower. I know know that as they build new prisons, they're taking that into account, and they are trying to include on-site interrogation facilities so prisoners can move back and forth more easily.
Mm. Well, much is unknown about this, but it would seem as if one thing that is known is that it indicates that Pentagon officials are digging in for the long run, both holding prisoners and what they expect to do in the future.
I definitely think the construction reflects a larger transition. It indicates that the administration has, as you mentioned, long-term plans for Guantanamo Bay and is not simply going to fold up the operation there now that there have been elections in Afghanistan and the intense conflict there is over.
Vanessa Blum is a reporter for The Legal Times. She spoke to us from Washington. Vanessa, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, now that Yasser Arafat's rule has ended, what happens next in the Middle East? Also, the man who read the Encyclopedia Britannica from Ayak to Zwayak. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Ending rumors that he would stay on as Secretary of State in a new Bush administration, Colin Powell delivered his resignation to President Bush today. Three other resignations were also confirmed this morning: Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham, Education Secretary Rod Paige, and Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman. This as lamakers of the 108th lame duck Congress reconvened to wrap up unfinished business. Well, joining us on the line is Jonathan Broder. He's foreign policy and defense editor at the Congressional Quarterly in Washington. And Jonathan, it's not really a shock that Powell is leaving, but there were some reports that he might want to stay on to forge a Mideast peace.
Yeah, there were, but I think that those were pretty much wishful thinking on the part of moderates in Congress, Europeans, people who look toward Colin Powell as the main moderate in the administration to pick up the ball on this opening that was created by the death of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. But in the end, it turned out to be exactly that, just wishful thinking.
And why did he leave? I mean, he has said he was just going to be a one-term secretary.
Well, it was not a surprise. I mean, he's been telling friends for months, actually, that he wanted to leave. And he began discussing his resignation with Bush probably about 2 months ago. He's been talking with Bush about this. He told his staff this morning at about 8:30, and then went to the White House after that to hand in his letter to Bush. The reason why he left, I think, is because he was not very effectual as a Secretary of State. As beloved as he was in the State Department and by moderates and by Europeans, on the main issues that he had to deal with, he basically lost. The first would be Iraq. He was in favor of assembling a much broader coalition before going to war. He lost on that. On North Korea, he wanted to begin the negotiations with the North Koreans where the Clinton administration had left off. And the rug was pretty much pulled out from under him when President Bush came into office. And on the Middle East, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, he was known to favor much greater involvement by the United States as a mediator than the Bush administration was willing to do.
And, of course, as some would say, he was burned by the false intelligence leading up to the war in Iraq. He's the one who presented it before the UN.
That's exactly right. I mean, one thing you can say about Colin Powell is that he was a good soldier. Mm-hmm. He did what the administration expected him to do, and he did make that case before the UN. Interestingly, he has said that he regrets having not vetted the information more closely and regrets some of the things that he said. But I think in the long term, history might be a bit kinder to Colin Powell than to the rest of the Bush administration, given his doubts and his reservations about what the administration was doing.
Well, staying with the here and now, with the right wing of the Republican Party feeling empowered to impose their agenda after President Bush's win, is there any chance that Colin Powell is going to surface in another role?
We don't know. There is a lot of desire among many to have him come back as perhaps a Middle East envoy, but we simply do not know that for now.
Some are saying that it's rumored that he might go to the World Bank.
I've heard that too, but once again, Robin, it's just too soon to tell right now.
Right. Well, he has said that he will stay in his role until a successor is named. One name being batted about is the National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. Your thoughts on that, and what other names are there?
Well, there are several names that are being bandied about, and it really all depends on which direction the administration wants to take on foreign policy. If it wants to maintain the same foreign policy that it had before, then what might happen is they might bring in someone like Paul Wolfowitz, right now the Deputy Secretary of Defense, to take Powell's place, and he would represent sort of the neoconservative view, a more sort of robust, militant foreign policy. Other names that are being mentioned are Condoleezza Rice, as you mentioned.
Does she want the job?
We don't know. She would be happy, I think, to stay on as National Security Advisor, but if that's not possible, if Bush wants her in a different role, then she is also a pretty good soldier and would do what the president wants. Another direction that the administration might take would be to appoint another moderate to the position to indicate that that is the direction that the administration wants to go. And in that case, it might be someone like the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Richard Lugar.
Mm. Well, let's move on to other news where you are. Someone who's fighting not just to keep his job but to maybe get a promotion is Senator Arlen Specter. He's next in line to be the next Judiciary Committee chairman, but the conservatives in the Republican Party are fighting that because of comments that he made about abortion and because he is a moderate of the party. How do you see this playing out?
Well, Specter is probably going to meet with the nine other Republicans on the Judiciary Committee probably on Tuesday afternoon to make the case that he should succeed the outgoing chairman, Orrin Hatch of Utah. So what Specter will be doing is meeting with them to try to convince them that he is the best person for the position. Now, it does not seem that the White House or his GOP colleagues for the moment are willing to sink his chairmanship.
But boy, has he been taking a brutal beating on the airwaves with the talk radio. And
he has. He's been taking that brutal beating mostly from conservatives outside Congress and the administration.
Well, this is, as we mentioned, a lame duck Congress. Can you just tick off for us some of the things that they might consider and hopefully might pass?
Well, the main thing that they have to do is they have to pass the nine remaining appropriations bills. They've only passed four of them so far. That's the main function of Congress, which is to, approve the money that that funds the government. They've passed four. They have nine more to go. And what they're probably going to do is fold all nine of those into a massive $388 billion omnibus spending bill. They have been negotiating the details of this over the weekend, and if I have to make a prediction, it looks pretty good that they will probably pass this omnibus bill.
Might they break the deadlock on legislation to implement the 9/11 Commission recommendations, the security bill?
That's another matter, Robin. They have been working on this as well since August. Where that stands right now is that you have two competing versions of an intelligence overhaul bill, one in the Senate and one in the House. The main sticking point is the degree of budgetary power that a new national intelligence director would have. The Senate version calls for a National Intelligence Director with broad budgetary authority over the entire intelligence community. The House version calls for a National Intelligence Director with weaker budgetary authority, which would leave much of the budgetary decision-making in the hands of the Pentagon. The Pentagon, as you may know, controls 80% of the intelligence budget, and they are loath to give up that power. So what this is basically is a turf battle, and right now the generals are winning.
Jonathan Broder, editor at the Congressional Quarterly in Washington, D.C. It looks to be, it's only Monday. We've had cabinet resignations. It looks to be an interesting week.
It sure will be.
Jonathan, thank you.
You're welcome.
Still to come, the flight and plight of Pedro Pons, young Cuban sent away to America in the early years of Castro's revolution. You're listening to Here and Now. Writer Meg Rossoff's first novel is How I Live Now. It focuses on the lives of children and adolescents in an age of terrorism. The main character, Daisy, goes to visit her aunt on a farm in rural England. While she's there, London comes under terrorist attack, leaving her stranded with her cousins and no adults. The children are left to take care of themselves and to deal with a war that creeps closer and closer to their rustic refuge. The book has won the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize and has been shortlisted for Britain's Whitbread Award for Children's Literature. And today Meg Rossoff reads a passage to us and explains why she chose adolescence as the subject of her first novel.
Well, I think the thing that interests me so much about adolescence is that it's a time where people change so extremely, and the very worst kind of people can become the very best kind of people, and the most confused can often come to some kind of an epiphany or go through a process of change. I mean, it really is possibly the time of greatest change in life and the greatest searching for clarity. So with all that metamorphosis going on, you can see it as a very dark time, but I think it's actually a really hopeful time when people can come into their own and come into a sense of their own strengths and their own ability to love, and also the redemptive power of love. And I think, you know, the writer's view always has a tendency to come through, and I'm a great optimist and a great believer in the healing power of love and of friendship and responsibility and all those sorts of things. The general feeling that comes out of the book is actually a terribly optimistic one, even though the themes are a bit on the dark side. This passage is Daisy talking about her mother's sister, and Daisy's mother died pretty much, although we never make it completely explicit, I mean, she died pretty much in childbirth, so she never really knew her mother. And this is the first time that she's met her mother's sister, and it's started her thinking about her mother, which is obviously something that pops into her head more often than she likes to admit. It was times like this when I let my guard down that Mom had a habit of strolling into my brain, even though she was dead, which made people put on this sickening, pious kind of face and say, oh, I am sorry, like it was their fault. And in fact, if everyone wasn't so busy apologizing all the time about asking a perfectly normal question like, where's your mother, I might have managed to get more information out of someone other than just, she died to give you life, which is the party line on good old Mom. It's a shame starting your first day on the planet as a murderer, but there you go, I didn't have much choice at the time. Still, I could live quite happily without the labels I picked up because of it. Murderer or poor motherless lamb. Which one would you choose, the rock or the hard place? Dad was one of those never mention her name again type of fathers, which, if you ask me, was extremely unpsychologically correct of him. Leah's father worked on Wall Street and shot himself one day when he lost $600 million of someone else's money, and they never shut up about him in their house. Which, as Leah likes to point out, is not the perfect answer either. I sometimes wish someone would fill me in on the simple, boring things like, did she have big feet or wear makeup? And what was her favorite song? And did she like dogs or have a nice voice? And what books did she read, etc.? I made up my mind to ask Aunt Penn some of these questions when she came back from Oslo, but I guess what you really want to know are the things you can't ask. Like, did she have eyes like yours? And when you pushed my hair back, was that what it feels like to have your mother do it? And did her hands look quiet and serious like yours? And did she ever have a chance to look at me with a complicated expression like the one on your face? And by the way, was she scared to die? Then Edmund and Piper came and lay down on the blanket, one on either side of me, with Piper holding my hand as usual, and Isaac still standing in the water looking peaceful. And they started arguing about what flies trout like best in a quiet, lazy sort of way. And Edmund blew smoke rings in the air, and I closed my eyes and wished they were mine.
Writer Meg Rossoff reading from her first novel, How I Live Now. It was announced last week that the book has been shortlisted for Britain's prestigious Whitbread Award for Children's Literature. Taking a second to remind you that we always welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And no one ever sends mail anymore. If you want to send some letters, you can send them to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. But please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Sonia Flew is a new play being staged at the Huntington Theater Company's new Calderwood Pavilion in Boston. It tells the story of a Minneapolis mom who must deal with the news that her son has decided to enlist to fight in Afghanistan.
Just finished school first. That's all I'm saying.
No substitute for life experience.
Yeah, you act as if it's perfectly reasonable for a boy.
Yeah,
right?
I am not
a boy. I mean, look at him.
Aged
in Ivy, he's a hockey player. I mean, he's just a Fulbright waiting to happen. And now his social conscience. Well, whatever happened to the war on poverty that those groups... Why not the Peace Corps, for God's sake? Do you have to use ammunition?
Well, there was that guy from school who went to the Peace Corps and got malaria and died.
Oh, not now.
But Sonia Flew is also the fact-based story of a trip the mother took over 30 years ago. As a teenager in Castro's Cuba, she joined a migration of Cuban children called Pedro Pans, or Peter Pans, because they were flown out of Cuba and into a Neverland called America by parents fearful of what the future would hold. Sonia Flew is the work of Cuban-American New Englander Melinda Lopez, who joins us in the studio.
Thank you.
And congratulations, your play is getting rave reviews.
Thank you so much.
But we want to learn more about this real-life migration that you write about. Over 14,000 children sent out of Cuba in early 60s, starts in 1959.
Right, 1960, I think, Christmas.
Why?
It's called Operation Pedro Pan, which makes it sound like it was a planned military thing. It was only named that much later by an American journalist who started writing about it. It was actually conducted in secret. The early part of the Cuban Revolution, after a time of great hopefulness by the people who brought Castro into power, they started becoming very fearful of what the future would hold. Many of the private schools were closed permanently, and there was apparent that the children were going to be reeducated, that the communist doctrine was going to become the main focal point of the education. There was also a rumor, which was never substantiated, but which caused parents to be very fearful that their rights as parents were going to be revoked, that after the age of three, all Cuban children would become would belong to the government. And we're talking about a culture where the family is so central and the really overprotective parents. I know, coming from parents, Cuban parents. So this real fear that they were losing control over what would happen to their kids.
Right. Well, you were lucky in a way in that your parents left Cuba. You were born in Colombia. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to make this sort of Sophie's choice that you write about in the play. The other parents had, sent their children away. Sonia, your character, was 15 at the time. Mm-hmm. She didn't want to leave, and you have a flashback in the play that describes that, and obviously she's still wrestling with it now as a mom years later. But what was that like? How did parents send their children away?
Well, I think, in Sonia's case, this case that I imagined, the most difficult thing for her to reconcile is that it wasn't her choice. And that she's presented with a decision that her parents have made because they're so afraid of what is going to become of her. And they see her at a time beginning to make her own choices, her own decisions.
They were afraid they were going to lose her to both the revolution or, some guys. Boys.
Liberty, the use of informants was common. Every neighborhood had someone that their job was just to watch you come in and go out of your house and notice how many packages you had and ask you where you got your groceries and notice who you were getting letters from. And so there was also a fear that perhaps unknowingly, unwillingly, your own children could become informants against you. And they just thought, I would rather send them somewhere that they will be free without me than risk seeing them become something that I can't bless, I can't love.
So we come to this, as you say, later called Operation Pedro Pan. It was sort of a loose conspiracy run by the Catholic Welfare Bureau and the American School in Havana and stewardesses and airlines. Everybody was complicit in trying to make it happen. When there was a physical moment where the children, and some of them tots, are in the airport, and there was a plexiglass or a glass enclosed area they were in. Tell me about that.
When you arrived at the airport, those people with tickets and visas to travel were brought into a glass containment area, and it was became known as the pecera, which is the fishbowl. In the play, I think it's a, you know, a really powerful scene where young Sonia walks through the pecera, where she goes through into the fishbowl, and her parents are calling to her to try to get her attention, and she doesn't hear them, or she won't look at them, and they're, you know, they're calling to her, and you can tell it, they've made the decision and they regret it, you know, and they don't know if they've done the right thing, and they're in such agony,
and they can't let on because they're being watched by Cuban authorities,
right? And all they can do is watch her go, and in the play we learn, you know, her parents don't survive the revolution to make the trip.
And ultimately, many of these children were reunited with their families that came to America. Many were not. They ended up in foster care in this country. Your character, Sonia, is one of those who never really understands what happened.
Right.
And what did happen in real life to many of those children? How, are they asking questions now? What's happening?
Sometimes they would spend 2, 3, 5 years before their parents were able to get out. And in that time, they learned English, they forgot Spanish, they became American, they survived. A child never gets over feeling like they were given up. It's their scars that just never heal. And so that was just tremendously moving to me.
And I'm wondering if that inspired Sonia Flew, because we meet in your play a woman who is wounded by that experience decades ago and now sees her son perhaps going off, and it's unbearable to her.
You know, what he wants to do is go and fight, be in the Marines, fight for his country, be on the front lines in the war against terrorism, and she cannot accept that. And it has nothing to do with her politics. It has to do with the fact that the choice is not hers.
Just as the
choice was not hers 40 years ago when her parents sent her out. And so what I hope is that we see this woman and we think, well, you know, this fight ensues. I mean, it threatens to destroy her family, her modern family. She cannot forgive her son. And I hope that we can watch her and go, well, even if I didn't agree with my children, I don't think I would go that far. What happened to her? And what we learn in the second act, we go back to Cuba 40 years earlier and we see her story. And her journey in the play is how to learn to forgive both her, you know, forgive her parents and forgive her son, forgive herself, forgive herself.
Such a profoundly sad story.
But I have to say, the play is an incredibly joyful one, too. I mean, the first act is set surrounding a holiday. There's a beloved grandfather that's coming. The family is full of laughter and joy. They love each other so much, and it's a joyous time. And we laugh so that we won't cry. You know, I think laughter is incredibly healing, important force in our lives, and I've always thought that even sad plays should be really funny. And this one is.
Melinda Lopez. Her new play, Sonia Flew, is at the Huntington Theater Company's new Calderwood Pavilion in Boston, South End. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.